weekend. And then we are continuing our series, Upside Down Kingdom, and this is a series in the Sermon on the Mount. And I forgot to mention one thing. We have two new leaders with us today. So Joseph and his wife Janiza, they are both over here. Raise your hand real quick. So they'll be both joining our freshmen. So Joseph will join the freshman guys. Janiza will join the freshman girls. You guys are really clappy this morning. That's really good. You guys got to clap. That's really impressive. So thank you for being here. Now they're clapping for their clapping. So yeah, we'll take all the clapping. But we started this series 2 weeks ago in the Sermon on the Mount, and we talked about the Beatitudes last week. You may have heard of those before, but we talked about how every disciple of Jesus needs to recognize their spiritual poverty before God. So the words of Jesus are, "Blessed are the poor in spirit." This is in reference to spiritual impoverishment before God, recognizing that we're bankrupt spiritually before God, which then lead to mourning over our sin, which then leads to meekness and then hungering and thirsting for righteousness, being merciful, being pure in heart, and being a peacemaker. And when you live this way, your reward is that you're probably going to get persecuted. That's going to happen in this life. But living this way also means you get to be a witness to a watching world. So there are two images that Jesus uses to describe this witness, and the images are salt and light. I think about how when Jesus was in his younger years, that maybe he's reflecting back in his youth and he's thinking about how just those two common things, like salt and light, were a part of every home. No matter how poor you were or even are today, those two things, salt and light, are very basic commodities. And that's true back then, it's true today, that everybody understands like how these things, these two simple things, how they're a part of our life, salt and light. So turn your Bibles to Matthew chapter 5, verse 13. "You are the salt of the earth, but if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet." So we know the world is an evil place. I don't have to convince you of that. You know that to be true. But it's not as evil as it could be. Do you ever think about that? Do you think about how, like, yes, we know that the world's an evil place, but do you ever have the thought, but things could be worse, right? Things could be even worse than they are. If whatever happens, you can always think of a worst-case scenario. So things are bad, but they're not as bad as they could be, because God's common grace is at work in the world. So that's basically the idea that rain falls on the just and the unjust. Even the unbeliever gets the benefit of the things that we have in this world. And so other elements of God's common grace, I think about government. So there's a way in which God is holding back evil, certain kinds of evil, through institutions like government. It doesn't mean that every single person in every single government is saved, because we know they're not. But government is set up by God. The institution of government set up by God through his common grace to hold back evil, and things aren't as bad as they could be because of things like government. Another example is just the institution of the family. So think of marriage. Marriage exists. Obviously, it's a picture of Christ's relationship to the church. So it's meant to be a picture of that. And it's much better if a couple, both of them, are walking believers, Christians, but because then they really understand what the marriage is pointing towards. But in another sense, there are unbelievers that are married to one another, and if they stay faithful to one another for their entire life, there is something good about that. There is something about God's common grace in that families can be started and there can be stability in society because of God's common grace and something as simple as a family united in marriage in the way that God intends. And I do believe that God obviously sees two unbelievers that are married. He still sees them as married, and he still sees it as an important thing. So there are ways in which God is holding back evil in our world through things like government and even the institution of the family and marriage. But there's another way that God influences society for good, and it's through the church. So if we live out our calling as disciples, as described in the Beatitudes, we can influence the world for good and keep it from completely unraveling. Now, why does Jesus choose salt as a picture of this influence? Well, in the ancient world, salt was a preservative. So they couldn't refrigerate meat to keep it from spoiling, so they would use salt. I think of my grandfather. I told you before that my grandfather had this big dairy farm where I grew up, and my house was really close to where he lived. So you can picture us living in this place. It was kind of like Little House on the Prairie, but it was with electricity. And so we lived just down the road from him, and he would have hogs, he would butcher hogs, he would do all the things that farmers would do. He had a big dairy farm. But one thing he would do, and he had this shed out behind his house, and one side of the shed was a wood shed because he used wood to heat his entire home. But then secondly, the other part of the shed was where he would hang dried meats. And he would take the leg of a pig, and he would wrap it in this kind of burlap sack and wrap it in salt and hang it up from the rafters. Now, this is not the kind of meat that he would want to eat. He had refrigeration. He had freezers for that stuff. But he would use this salt pork. My grandmother would take it down. It would be up there for months. And you'd walk into that shed and have a very distinct smell. It actually smelled pretty good. But it was salted meats hanging up in these bags up above the rafters so that rats couldn't get into them. And they would take those things down when it was time. And they would cut the meat. And they would put it in things like beans for flavor. It was like salt pork. But that's how he would preserve the meat. So you could do that. So back in the day when they had no refrigeration, this is how all meats had to be preserved. Is it would the salt would hold back the decay from invading the meat. And this is the image that Jesus uses to describe Christians and the church and their role in the world. He uses his image because he knows that because of sin, the world is on a pathway towards decay and destruction. But if his disciples live out what we described last week, then we can play a role in delaying this decay that is going to happen to the world through sin. So we're never going to see perfection in this world because the world is lost apart from Christ. But Christians can still have great influence in society. And that's what Jesus is talking about here. You know, some Christians think that once they become a Christian, they think, we should just all go live in a holy commune, completely separate from the world. But salt doesn't do any good if it sits on a shelf separate from the meat. It's got to be up close if it's going to affect it. This is why Christians cannot separate faith from the rest of their lives. So we cannot place our faith in a little private compartment on a shelf somewhere. The salt can't stay in the salt shaker. It needs to be spread around for it to be effective. So if you're a Christian, you must be a Christian all the time. That means in your school, you're a devoted follower of Christ. That means at your job. That means on your team. You might be the only person that you know in your school or on your team. But it's important to be a Christian all the time in your friend group. You don't get to take a Christian time out when you're with certain people. You don't get to do that. None of us do. In John 17, Jesus prayed this very interesting prayer for the church. Do you know that it's amazing to look at this? If you go to John 17, you see where Jesus, he prays not just for his current disciples back then, but he prays for the church in the future. Like in John 17, Jesus prays for you and me. Did you know that? You can open the scriptures and see when Jesus prayed for you in John 17. And here's what he says in John 17, verse 14 to 18. I have given them your word, and the world has hated them because they are not of the world. Just as I am not of the world, I do not ask that you take them out of the world, but that you keep them from the evil one. They are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. Sanctify them in the truth. Your word is truth. As you sent me into the world, so I have sent them into the world. So verse 14 echoes what we heard last week, that we're going to be persecuted for our faith. And if that happens, there are two ways in which Christians are tempted. One is to become separate from the world and to create a holy commune apart from everyone and have your own little place and you never get affected by the world. And there are a lot of Christians that try to live that way. They think their role in the world is just to hang on real tight until Jesus comes back. But that's not our calling. The other way in which Christians can be tempted is to compromise with the world. That means to become so part of the world that no one can see any distinction, any difference between you and someone who's not a Christian. And this is compromising to our faith. So Jesus does not want us taken out of the world. We've got to be in the world if we're going to affect it. But we also should not compromise with the world, adopting its values and principles. Jesus wants us to stay in it, but while we're in it, to be kept from evil, as he prays here for the church. So what is one of the primary ways in which the human body, think about the human body, so what is one of the primary ways in which the human body releases salt? You guys do this a lot in the summertime in Texas. How does the body release salt? What is it? Sweat. And we sweat a lot in the summer in Texas. So perspiration. But here's what happens. If your body does not give off salt through sweating, do you know what happens? Your body begins to retain water and it becomes what? It becomes bloated, right? Retains water. In the same way, the church becomes bloated and unhealthy if salt is not released and dispersed. And we don't want to be like that kind of Christian. Look back at verse 13. When he says, you're the salt of the earth. So for salt to be effective, it needs to retain its saltiness. Salt's only job is to be salty. The phrase, you had one job, right? And it's to be salty. And if you fail at that one job, salt, then you have failed to be salt. That is your only role in the world, is to be salty. Now, technically, salt can never lose its saltiness. It's a chemical compound. I know school just started, but anyone know what two chemicals make salt? Just say them real quick. Anyone? Sodium chloride. You guys covered that already this year? It's only 2 weeks in. Anybody know the chemical compound? Like, what's the symbol for that? Do you know what it is? Oh, man. Like, it's like the chemistry kids all sat together over here this morning. They're all like in unison. It's like a chant. NaCl. Yeah. So this chemical composition cannot be changed, but it can become contaminated. So the composition, if you test it, you can't change it, but it can become contaminated with other elements, other things, if it's mixed with other things, right? Now, some believe Jesus could be referring to a type of salt found around the Dead Sea. If we were to test that kind of salt, there would be sodium chloride in it, but many other elements as well, making it ineffective. If you don't know the geography of Israel, on the eastern part of the country, there is the Sea of Galilee way up north, and then the Jordan River flows from north to south. From Sea of Galilee, the Jordan River flows south all the way to the Dead Sea. What's happening today is there's so much irrigation happening with the Jordan River because they're always having droughts. They need to have water for people and also for plants and animals. So because of that, the Jordan River can't keep up with filling up the Dead Sea. So this is a picture of part of the Dead Sea because the Dead Sea is dying even more so than it already was. It's drying up and it's kind of a crisis for Israel. Now, I had a chance to go there. That's not us. Those are strangers off the internet. But we had a chance to go visit the Dead Sea when I was in Israel back in 2022. And it's an eerie, apocalyptic place because it is the lowest point on earth. It is the absolute lowest point, I think about 1,700 feet below sea level. There's this kind of mountain range that goes where Jerusalem is, and it kind of goes way down towards the Dead Sea. So when you're there, because when you guys think about being at the beach, what do you think of? Like, what are the sounds and sights you think of at the beach? You think of seagulls. You think of there's wind. There's a breeze usually. Being at the beach feels kind of nice, unless you live in Texas where it's 120 degrees. But most places you think of, it feels nice to be at the beach. And you don't have any of that at the Dead Sea. None of that exists because nothing can live in the Dead Sea. No animals or no plants can live in the Dead Sea because it's so full of minerals and salt that nothing, life cannot be sustained there. So guess what? When you don't have any fish or any wildlife in the water, guess what? You also don't have any birds flying around. And so it's like eerily quiet. It's a strange, eerie, apocalyptic place. And everything is just dead. You will see no boats on the Dead Sea because the water would just eat their boats alive. You couldn't have a boat out there. No one's kayaking on the Dead Sea. You get in the Dead Sea for a few minutes, and you can kind of, your body will float because it's so buoyant. And the water kind of feels like real oily, and you get out and you're like, I'm covered in oil. It feels like I suntan oil like everywhere. It's a weird feeling. But you can float in the Dead Sea, so no one can drown in the Dead Sea, thankfully. You can't really scuba dive. You can't snorkel. You can't even put your head underwater because it's like you will feel, when you're in this water, you will feel, if you have any minor cuts on your body, you will instantly feel this burning sensation because the water is so potent with minerals and salt. It's a strange and weird place. But some think that Jesus might be referring to a certain kind of salt that you will find around by the Dead Sea when he uses this picture. Because he could be referring to a residue that looked like salt and had salt-like qualities, but it doesn't taste like salt or act like salt. If you tested the salt that you see here, it will definitely have NaCl in it, but it will have lots of other things mixed in as well. And so here's the picture. If Christians become contaminated by the world's impurities, they lose their influence. If salt becomes contaminated, it loses its ability to be salt. If we're going to influence society, we've got to be distinct, not identical like the world. Martin Lloyd-Jones says this, "The glory of the gospel is that when the church is absolutely different from the world, she invariably attracts it. It is then that the world is made to listen to her message, though it may hate it at first." So if we're just like the world, well, why would the world be compelled to listen if we act and talk just like the world? You know, some Christians, so-called Christians, they try to gain the respect of the world by becoming like the world. Some Christians think, you know what, we need some more street cred as Christians, so I'm going to talk like them, act like them, because we need to have their respect. But what happens is those people, they get trampled underfoot. They become like road dust, insignificant, inconsequential as it relates to this world. Another function of salt is what? You guys use it for your meals to provide flavor. You know, we never just eat salt by itself unless you're weird. Like no one ever goes, some salt, yum, yum, I want to have some salt. Now, it's usually mixed into a dish to make it more flavorful and more enjoyable. I will tell you that another thing that we use is butter. So butter is meant to be used like on something or in something. When I was a kid, I loved butter. I loved it on bread, but there were times when I would just dig my finger in the butter thing and just be like, this is good. I would eat butter sometimes like that. But you're not supposed to do stuff like that with butter or salt. You should never eat it by itself. But it's mixed in to make it more flavorful, more enhanced, more enjoyable. It enhances that which is already there. So I want you to think of all the pleasures that God gives us in this life. And there's a long list of what those are. If we enjoy those things apart from Jesus, they remain bland and flavorless. Like the world thinks they're having all kinds of fun and amazing pleasure in the ways they want to do that. But the reality is God's given us certain pleasures to be used in certain contexts. And if we try to go outside of his context and the confines he's created for certain things, then those things actually become less pleasurable outside of the ways in which he designed it. But inside the ways in which God designed things, then it's much better in those contexts because that's how God designed it. But if we see the pleasures of life as gifts from God, allowing them to point us to worship, those things become more enjoyable, not less. Another function of salt is to make us thirsty. So if we eat a salty meal, we crave water. We get thirsty because of it. So we get thirsty. So do our lives make people thirsty for Jesus? Do our lives exhibit joy and satisfaction and peace in him that makes other people sit up and take notice and say, I want to worship the same Jesus they worship? You know, for many of us, we may not find joy in the Christian life. So why would anyone else look at us and desire it? In Jerusalem, at the end of Hezekiah's tunnel, which I've talked about that with you before, there is a pool called the Pool of Siloam. So if you walk through Hezekiah's tunnel in Jerusalem, it's kind of an interesting place. I won't tell details about that now, but I have before. You walk through this long tunnel with the water kind of rushing to the bottom of it, and it's kind of a scary place to walk through, but lots of tour guides will take you there. And you come out of this place called the Pool of Siloam. Now, it's not that impressive today, but it's still there. And many people believe that when, in the times of Jesus, at the end of this location where the Pool of Siloam was located, in ancient times during the Feast of Tabernacles in Jerusalem, a priest would go down to the Pool of Siloam each day and return with large containers of water that were emptied on the altar up at the temple. And this would last 7 days during the Feast of Tabernacles. On the last day, this was repeated 7 times. In John chapter 7, when Jesus attends the Feast of Tabernacles, it says, on the last day of the feast, the great day, Jesus stood up and cried out, if anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink. Whoever believes in me, as the scripture has said, out of his heart will flow rivers of living water. So people are spiritually thirsty, and only Jesus can bring them satisfaction. So we can't satisfy their thirst, but we can point them to the only one that can do that for them. So salt makes people thirsty. Do our lives make them thirsty for the living water that only Jesus can bring? Another quality of salt is that it is very common. It is found everywhere. Salt really isn't all that valuable. It's in every house that we have. It's found everywhere. It's not that valuable by itself. So Jesus uses common things to accomplish great things. Jesus uses very everyday common things to accomplish great things. He says, you are the salt of the earth. He does not say, you are the gold of the earth, or you're the diamonds of the earth. He says, you're the salt of the earth. It's very common. So you and I, we're not that important in the grand scheme of things. We're not that valuable in and of ourselves. Paul says this in 1 Corinthians. He says that God uses the common things, the weak things, that's us, to shame the wise. So Jesus is saying that we're like salt. Like there's an aspect of us, it's like we're very common and we're not that valuable by ourselves, but we can accomplish great things through his purposes and his plan for our lives. So we see this theme all throughout the Bible. In the Garden of Eden, what did God use to make man? Did he use gold, silver, or iron? No, he didn't use those elements. He used dust. God used dirt to make man and to make woman. We're not that important, but we get to point people to an all-powerful God. Look at verse 14 to 16. It says, you are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others so they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. How many of you guys, as I read the passage, you thought of the little song when you were a kid that you learned, right? The little, you know the song, right? This little light of mine, right? That song. So that comes from this passage. The other metaphor that Jesus uses for his followers is light. And now he says about himself that he is the light of the world. So how are we also the light if Jesus is the true light of the world? Well, some have used the analogy of the sun and the moon. Like Jesus is like the sun, which emanates its own light source. That's Jesus. But that we're like the moon, that we don't have light in and of ourselves, but we reflect the sun. We reflect Jesus to the world. So I titled this sermon, The Witness of Works. And I don't mean that Christians simply do some good works in front of a watching world, and that's it. Because Buddhists, Muslims, Hindus, all kinds of people can do some good works, but they're not pointing people to Jesus. So part of our good work has to be evangelism. Part of our good work has to be sharing our faith, not giving glory to ourselves. Jesus says our good works should cause people to give glory to God. So our works should not point to ourselves or point to us. It gives glory to God. But part of those good works is sharing the good news about Jesus. That's part of the work we're supposed to be doing. So we would never, in your house, you would never light a lamp and then try to hide the light. You light it, you put it on display. What are some ways that Christians can hide their light? It might be through sin, compromise, laziness, just being fearful of someone's reaction. You know, some Christians might be like a little night light, just barely on, very dim, just barely on. While some Christians might be like an annoying flashlight, like shining it in someone's face. You're like, this is the truth. And you're like one of those annoying people who's just like shining it right in their eyes. So we're not to be like that, but also not to be like a little dim nightlight, just barely on. But what keeps us from influencing the world for good? There's a few ideas here. Belief that the world will only get worse. Some Christians think, well, things are just going to get worse, so what's the point of trying to make things better in this life? That they're all about the future, and that's all they focus on as opposed to the present. And that's not really the right way to approach things. The next idea is the belief that Christians should only be concerned about salvation. So they only think about evangelism, which is super important, but they neglect the poor. They neglect people that might be in need in the here and now. And they don't maybe take up causes unless they are simply just evangelistic. And that is super important, but we're also called to feed and clothe the poor and to be a resource for people that are in need. The other thing that can keep us from influencing the world for good is the belief that politics is a dirty business. So there are some Christians that think, you know what, the whole thing is just broken, so I'm just going to tap out, not be a part of anything that sort of like has some social cause to it. And so that's not really the call for, I think, Christians to declare that we can't have any influence in even some of the difficult places like politics. Christians should be, I think, involved in those things, whether it's running for office or being people that vote and try to vote for things that would glorify God. The last thing is the belief that Christians should adopt the world's values in business and politics. This is the opposite of this last one I just shared, because there are some Christians that think, you know what, if you're going to play in the world, you got to be like the world. And they do it in business, so they do dishonest dealings in the business world and think, I got to play on this stage, so I got to be like the world. And there are many Christians today do the same thing in politics. So they think, you know, we got to play the world's game. We got to do what they do because this is just how it is. And that's just false. Christians don't have to play the world's game, whether it comes to politics or business. You're called to be salt and light, no matter what area of the world you live in. So Christians must see their witness as twofold. The first is we're to be salt, which is like preventing decay. And this is keeping the negative from happening. This could be like, I think of the place we went to in New York, in the Bronx especially, the house on Beekman. You heard about it like last Wednesday, where those people, they're being like, they're Christians, but they're also being like salt in that place. It's a broken place. They're being salt because they're trying to help people get educated in a difficult environment. And that's like being salt to that community. And then secondly, we are also to be light. That's illuminate darkness, speak truth. That is bringing something positive. That not just in action, but also in words and preaching the gospel to people. So salt and light, we've got to keep those things together. God wants us to have a double influence on society. We can help prevent decay, and we can bring light to the darkness. We stop the spread of evil, but we also spread the truth. You know, there are some Christians who want to only do, like, social action and that's it. Like, just feed the poor, just clothe the poor, which those are important things, and they fail to evangelize. Then there are some people who only want to just preach the gospel and don't actually do the deeds that we're talking about. And we've got to maintain both. Here's a quote from John Stott. He says, "We should never pit our two vocations to be salt and light over against each other as if we had to choose between them. We should not exaggerate either nor disparage either at the expense of the other. Neither can be a substitute for the other. The world needs both. It is bad and needs salt. It is dark and needs light. Our Christian vocation is to be both. Jesus Christ said so, and that should be enough. We must not be shy of our vocation to be salt as well as light, or we shall be guilty of separating what Jesus has united." You guys are going to head to your breakouts right now, so I think you guys should know where to go. If you don't know where to go and you're kind of new, then come ask me. Seniors, go to the portables. And leaders, discussion sheets are